Good morning.
I'm always very impressed by the large crowds that come out to hear ancient Near Eastern scholars speak about their stuff. At least it happens in Paris. I'm not even sure that would happen in New York, but Paris is a great place to be an intellectual. Many thanks to Jean-Marie Douan and Thomas Romea for the generous invitation to bring me all the way from Atlanta to be here and to participate in this very interesting colloquium. My subject today, the relationship between prophets and kings, is one that many of my colleagues have written on already at great length. Dominique Chapin, Jean-Marie Douan, André Lemaire, and as well as others who are not here with us today, such as Marty Nissenen, Nick Verhuis, Alan Lenzi, Seth Richardson, and especially Beate Pankratz-Leisten. I mention these scholars by name because their brilliant work has significantly shaped my own approach to the subject in relation to the biblical evidence. Now, some of you may remember reading in the newspapers last fall how the government of Romania, in an effort to raise extra revenues for the country's suffering economy, attempted to instate a new tax on witches, fortune tellers, astrologers, prophets, and other mantic professionals. The legislation was voted down, however. The reasons for the rejection offered in the media was not only that it would be difficult to administer, but also that many Romanian politicians feared the curses that these professionals threatened to pronounce against them. Thus, my topic has contemporary relevance. However, my reason for choosing it is due less to current issues in Romanian politics than to my interest in what is perhaps the most thorny problem in biblical research: the emergence of the Bible's massive corpus of prophetic literature and its distinctive depictions of prophets. The problem is perhaps one of the most perplexing in biblical studies, even more vexing and difficult than the emergence of the Pentateuch in the so-called Deuteronomistic history, and perhaps more important given the importance of prophetic literature on the former. Against the backdrop of the ancient Near Eastern prophetic text, the Hebrew Bible stands out quite sharply. In contrast to the relatively close association between king and prophet in the 18th century Mari text and those from 7th century Assyria, the Bible often presents a deep antagonism between the king and the prophet. Thus, think of the scene in the David and Bathsheba story, in which the prophet Nathan approaches the throne and proclaims, "Atah ha'ish, you are the guilty one," to the king. In the biblical narrative, it is the role of the prophet, not that of the king, that survives the encroachment of imperial powers in the southern Levant. Thus, at a time when Persian rule precluded the possibility of reestablishing a monarchy in Judah, prophets continue to be well represented. All the more so with respect to the literary tradition. After the defeat of the Judahite kingdom in 586, and apparently to a similar extent after the destruction of the kingdom of Israel in 722, the writings not only continue to be transmitted, but also to be embellished, expanded, redacted, and reinterpreted. As the prophets grew in importance in both society and the literary tradition, biblical authors and interpreters of the exile and post-exilic period biblical authors and interpreters of the exilic and post-exilic period sought to affirm the continuity between their own time and the early history of Israel. In addition to the leadership of Devorah and Samuel, they identify the nation's first leader, Moses, as a prophet who stands over against the foreign king. Voicing a rather extreme opposition to kingship, the 13th century Jewish thinker Nachmanides underscores the significance of the depiction of Moses in the Torah. Quoting a line from the Talmud, Ula said that Moses, our teacher, sought kingship, but it was not granted to him. Now, this is Nachmanides speaking, it was not the purpose of the scholar to state merely that Moses wanted kingship and lordship over Israel and that God denied it to him, but rather that God chose not a king over Israel, but a prophet, a leader, and a judge like Moses, all of which proves that a king is neither required nor beneficial for Israel. And then he goes on to quote Hosea 13. Now, in keeping with the way in which the prophet ultimately trumps the king, biblical prophetic literature in its transmitted forms is characterized by various features. A demotic, or what I would call horizontal or national purview. This is number three on the... It addresses a collective people rather than solely a king. Take, for example, Amos 5:1. Hear this word that I take up over you in lamentation, O house of Israel. It's not addressed to the king. Likewise, the prophetic literature has a didactic purpose, which is not confined to an audience of the palace or court scribes, such as the Fürstenspiegel literature in Babylonia, which also has a didactic character. Now, these two aspects of prophetic literature are undeniably related to the more basic, yet nevertheless historically remarkable fact that prophetic literature has been preserved in the first place, and not only preserved, but also heavily redacted, expanded to a massive corpus, and transmitted and commented upon for so many centuries. Yet how do we account for the genesis of these writings? In the next 20 minutes, I would like to offer several points that I think are worthy of consideration when addressing the problem. Specifically, I will identify three socio-political factors that converge to create the necessary conditions for the emergence of our prophetic text. Number one, the special relationship between the states of Israel and Judah. Number two, the defeat of these states, of Judah in 586, but especially of Israel in 722. And then three, the different nature of statehood in the southern Levant. Now, the first of these two factors are closely related and are best treated together. So let me begin by explaining what I mean by the special relationship between the states of Israel and Judah and what it has to do with the emergence of prophetic literature. The Bible presents Israel as a people before it entered the land and before it established a centralized state in the reign of Saul and David and Solomon. Later, this kingdom splits into two states, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Thus, the Bible presents one people divided into two states. Yet here, the Bible cannot be accepted at face value. It is doubtful that the inhabitants of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah saw themselves as one people, at least not in the beginning. The historical data leaves no doubt that Israel was a stronger and more influential power in the southern Levant, much more powerful than Judah, its southern neighbor. In fact, Israel was so strong that it succeeded in exerting its political influence over Judah, making this kingdom its vassal for a period of time, and constantly interfering in local politics, in internal politics. The long years of Israel's hegemony in Judah inevitably made a cultural and religious impact, or had an impact. Thus, we can witness through cultural mimesis, Judah embraced architectural forms from the north, such as these proto-Aeolic capitals that we witness in Jerusalem and Ramat Rachel, probably coming down from influence from the north. Such evidence suggests that some elites in Judah would also have been eager to adopt Israel's ideologies and cultic practices as well, while others would have sharply rejected the cultural and political influence in order to maintain a distinct Judean identity. So you have both ways. And later, I would say, as the Assyrians conquered Israel in 722, many in Judah would not likely have mourned the fate of their northern neighbor. Which brings me to the second factor, defeat. The foreign occupation and the destruction of Israel left the kingdom of Judah as one, if not the most important power in the southern Levant. Various circles in Judah viewed themselves as divinely vindicated and commissioned to carry on Israel's legacy. As Israel's cultural heir and political successor, the kingdom became an important context in which Israel's literature was transmitted, read, and redacted and reinterpreted. Among the texts from Israel that were being read in Judah were not only national narratives that would become a central component of the later Pentateuch and former prophets, but also prophetic writings. Yet perhaps more important than the transmission of any specific text was the political discourse that Judah inherited from Israel and broadened. In laying claim to the succession of Israel, some circles in Judah emphasized the superiority of its dynasty, the line of David, while other circles, and this is the most important point, pointed to a deeper common identity independent of the royal houses. That common identity was a national one, namely Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, What later grows out of this discourse on peoplehood is an emphasis on one deity that we hear in the Shema Israel. The Lord, your hero Israel, the Lord your God, is our God, the Lord is one. From here, we come quickly to the Deuteronomic covenant ratified by the deity and the whole people of Israel, now, of course, including the inhabitants of the kingdom of Judah. In all of this, the king plays a very subordinate or no role whatsoever. It is Moses who mediates between the two parties, creating an ideal that shapes the identity of other prophets in Israel as figures whose messages are addressed to the entire people rather than solely the king. So in seeking to account for the distinctive demotic, horizontal, and national emphasis in the biblical prophetic literature, I would point to the project of peoplehood among Judean authors who sought to find a common identity uniting Israel and Judah after the defeat of Israel in 722. This brings me to the third and final factor, the different nature of statehood and degrees of state centralization in the southern Levant in Mesopotamia. Against the backdrop of the cuneiform evidence of Mesopotamia, the biblical depictions of prophets stand out in sharp contrast. Whereas the prophets and diviners in Mesopotamia affirm their loyalty to the king, the biblical ideal of the prophet stands often in opposition to the palace. Taking ancient Athenian political discourse and modern Western democracy as the standard, one asks, how did Israel manage to develop this culture of dissent, whereas Mesopotamian and Egyptian civilizations remained focused on the person of the king and leave little room for political opposition to the palace? The formulation of this question presupposes a teleology, with Israel representing a more advanced stage in political development because of its higher tolerance for dissent. I would suggest that this question is posed falsely. It needs to be reversed. That is to say, the problem is not explaining the development in Israel, but rather in Mesopotamia, and in Egypt for that matter. There, rulers succeeded in creating very centralized polities. Here I would draw attention to Max Weber's concept of Gewaltmonopol, the state's attempt to monopolize force. In order to achieve this monopoly, states naturally seek to control political opposition. And in ancient Western Asia, such political opposition could originate from prophets. Thus, it is not surprising that the cuneiform record for prophets and mantic professionals from 18th century Mari or Sargonid Assyria witnesses to the efforts of the palace to exert its influence over already ancient and established sectors of society that were potentially inimical to the political designs of the king. Much of this record consists of letters to the king from diviners themselves or from officials conveying the words of prophets. In doing so, the senders are demonstrating, and they often even draw attention to this, they're demonstrating their allegiance to the king and fulfilling their obligation to accurately and immediately report all oracles and prophetic activity. Now, with respect to the haruspices and the astrologers, these professionals, which are called later scholars in the Neo-Assyrian period, the Umani, were generally easier to control for the palace. Nevertheless, even they posed political threats sometimes. This fact explains why, in an important text from Amari, edited by Douan, the so-called Protocol of the Baru, Ahasuerus writes to Zimri Lim at great length. So this Ahasuerus writes to him, affirming his loyalty and swearing to accurately report everything he witnesses, to never perform a haruspicy at the command of anyone who speaks secretly against the king, and to divulge any rumors of insurrection among his fellow haruspices. From the Neo-Assyrian period, we may compare this text to a letter from a Babylonian haruspex named Kuduru, who writes the king informing how the chief eunuch and fellow conspirators forced him to undertake an extirpacy in order to find out if it was an auspicious time for a coup d'etat. It's a wonderful text telling about how he's brought up into a room, sat down, made to drink wine for all day long, and then in the end, they let him know what they want, and they want him to form the expose. And he writes to the king saying, I had to do it, I had no other choice, and in order to make sure that he doesn't get in trouble later. But a greater threat, however, was not from these inductive haruspices and extapice and astrologers, but rather from the non-rational, non-inductive forms of divination, what we heard about a lot yesterday, the ecstatics and the dreamers who sometimes performed their prophecies in public spaces. We know of, in various texts, both from Mari and the New Assyrian period, from the palace gate, Inabab Ekalim, the assembly of the elders, Puchushibi, or of the entire land. Both in Mari and in Assyria, we hear about a prophecy voice throughout the entire land, Inapuchur Matim. In the reign of Esarhaddon, we hear also of a certain slave girl on the outskirts of Haran, who since the month of Sivan, we're told, is enraptured, Sarhat, and proclaims the death of the king and his dynasty. She yells, she's repeating this over and over, this is the word of the god Nusku. The kingship is for Sassi. I will destroy the name and the seed of Sanhawiv. The one who writes to inform Esarhaddon urges him to take immediate action and to annihilate the conspirators who stand behind this prophecy. Now, as Martti Nissinen has shown, this letter makes explicit appeal to the terminology of the succession treaty of Esarhaddon from 672 BCE, which is known to many of us because of its close correspondence to Deuteronomy 13, an overstudied text, in my opinion. One passage of the treaty mentions explicitly prophets and the requirement to report their insurrectionary words to the king. We quote here, if you hear any evil, improper, ugly word which is not seemly nor good from the mouth of the prophet, of a prophet, an ecstatic, an inquirer of oracles, inapivaragimi, mache, marashaili, amatili, or from the mouth of any human being at all, you shall not conceal it, but come and report it to Ashurbanipal, the great crown prince, Dexinit, son of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria. This is an oath, an aday that they're made to take and swear to. In the reign of Esarhaddon, oracles were announced to the king in front of the people during state ceremonies. So older oracles that were being stored would be placed on the lips of either priest or in the, those who are participating in the rituals. To cite one example, listen to this. Hear, O Assyrians, the king has vanquished his enemy. Your king has put his enemy under his foot. One cannot help thinking about the Shema Yisrael when one reads that. Due to the great political turmoil and civil war that accompanied the succession of the throne of Sanharif, Esarhaddon and later his son Ashurbanipal repeatedly announce in their inscriptions, and they make this very prominent in the narratives, that they received prophetic messages, shipir mache, as well as dreams from various sources. And all these support their rule, meaning that Ishtar is on the side of Esarhaddon and his son Ashurbanipal. Ashurbanipal even cites prophecies, quasi-verbatim in his inscriptions. All of this is in order to make sure that no one questions the legitimacy of the rule. Thus, they're all trying to get prophecy and the diviners under their control, under the state monopoly, what Beate Pangratz-Leisen calls Herrschaftswissen, going back to an older concept. It is in this context that we must understand why prophecies were being collected from smaller, what we call U'ilu text, and transferred to larger, beautifully arranged tupu formats and stored in the libraries. The reason was not to facilitate reading and the study of these texts among scribes, as much as it was their use in later propagandistic inscriptions and rituals and so forth, to make sure that all of these could be easily accessible. Now, if I had more time, I would discuss various other means in which the palace sought to bring prophets and diviners under the control, such as bestowing on them gifts. We have many receipts of these gifts from Mari, consisting often of garments, but also a donkey, monumental weapons, and precious metals. They're rewarding their prophets with these things. The king also granted his diviners properties. We have lots of letters in the Neo-Assyrian period where the diviners are writing, my piece of land has been taken away from me, your father gave it to me, please make sure that you return it to me. And as well as the kings are very interested in making sure that they are seen as attending to the needs of the gods in whose names these prophets speak. The Mari letters remind the god needs to be fed, please feed him. And in doing that, the king is also showing that he's very much in creating a relationship with these prophets so that they are on his side. And not least, that they heeded the critiques and the advice voiced in the prophecies and in the letters that are often reporting the results of the oracle queries. The point in drawing attention to all this evidence is to show that even the very centralized states of Zimri-Lim and the Sarkhanid Assyria, in the process of creating a Gewalt monopole and a Wissens monopole, went to great length to hold in check divination, prophecy, and the threats that they could pose. Now, if that was the case for Mari, and here's my point, how much more so for Israel? Now, Israel, you might say, is a smaller state. Doesn't need to have so much state control. Assyria, the kingdom of Zimri-Lim, is a much larger one. But if we look at the biblical evidence, we see a lot of remarkable features of prophets who are on the periphery, who are not under the control of the state. Think here, first prophet that we hear about in the Bible, in the Pentateuch, Bileam. Who does he work for? He's hired by a king. Hired by a king to go and to curse Israel. Here's an example. He's given many gifts, and every time Bileam goes and tries to pronounce a curse, it turns into a blessing. The point is that Bileam is not working specifically for one king, but can be hired by various ones. Think also of the school, in this term also, the schools of the prophets. These schools of the prophets we hear in maybe perhaps most of you in terms of Elijah and Elisha. They are the fathers and they have their sons. They're called the B'nai HaNevi'im. They have their own place. Some of the narratives tell that they're too large. So they go and build another house. They live on the periphery. They're worried about making a survival, but they're not working for the king. Now, of course, this literature might be late, but I can't imagine that the biblical authors invent that from nothing, especially as we see a very close association between that type of culture and later schools that are within late antiquity. Also look at how Naaman, a foreign king, can hire a prophet from Israel. The prophets are seen as not working specifically for the court. Then we have many texts throughout the Bible that refer to the prophets at the courts of the kings being fed by them. Many times, for example, think of 1 Kings 13, an anonymous man of God comes to the king, gives him a prophecy, and the king then offers, come home with me and dine, and I will give you a gift. But the man of God said to the king, if you give me half of your kingdom, I will not go home with you, nor will I eat food or drink and water in this place. For thus I was commanded by the word of the Lord, you shall not eat food and drink water or return by the way that you came. So he went to another way and went home. Think also of the 400 prophets of Baal who were at the table of Jezebel in the palace of Ahab. In this context, we can think of Elijah, who is eating, being fed, according to the rabbis. He's being fed by the ravens in the Bible, but the rabbis say, where did the ravens get the bread? They're picking up from the table of Ahav. Others say, well, they need kosher, so it must have been Jehoshaphat. But the point is that here the ideal of the prophet is one that is independent, on the periphery, not in the control of the state. Now, of course, that's the ideal that the biblical authors are moving towards. They see with lots of skepticism and suspicion the prophets who work at the courts of the king. My point in drawing all this together, though, is to suggest that the development of the court prophet is not one of which a pagan culture in which the Israel is moving out of. in order to come to a culture of prophets that are much more in a culture of dissent. But rather, that culture of dissent is the older culture, and it's moving towards more centralization at the court. So that the biblical authors, in the end, when they cast aspersions on the court prophets, they're not doing so out of some innate, deeply seated conservatism that would rather have the prophets of the ancient times before there was the king. What is going on, and this is part of my first suggestions, is that the defeat of the state of Israel in the later Judah has come together with a prophetic culture that goes way back in time, and that the two converge in order to create the prophetic literature that we have. The state is the problem. Peoplehood is the future. It is also the past. Am Israel is what will continue on. And in terms of coming to grips with a project of statehood that was ultimately destroyed, the biblical authors point to the people of Israel as the continuum that endures throughout Israel's history. And it's that peoplehood and the prophets that serve the larger project of that peoplehood, not the king, not the state, that is what is so central in the biblical literature. I look forward to your suggestions. Thank you.